Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Who's Alex Nudman?
How did you find that?
Do me research, Fred.
Oh my God.
Have you ever had this thing where people like don't eat with your left hand? So I was eating and with my left hand, because that's how I've been trained because I went to school. And, you know, I'm eating with my left hand, fork in the left hand, knife in the right, and the father is just staring daggers at me. And I'm like, Uncle, everything okay? He's like, Artif, stop eating with your left hand. He's like, why, Uncle? He's like, you must never eat with your left hand. I said, why, Uncle? What's wrong with eating with your left hand? So you shouldn't eat with your left hand because you wipe your bum with your left hand. So don't eat with your left hand. I'm like, Uncle, you ain't gonna like what I do with my right hand. Seriously, you're not. You're not gonna like that at all.
Atif Nawaz, how are you doing?
I'm great, Tom. I'm very, very well. How are you?
I'm all good. I need to know, though, why were you thrown in a pool in your suit the other day? What have you done?
I did imply that I was thrown into a suit, a pool with my suit, when the real truth would be that I fell into a pool with my suit on. I just, you know, I like to evoke those wrestling stories. Like, you know, you hear all these amazing wrestling stories of, like, you know, people falling into Vince McMahon's pool in his house. And I thought, if I'm gonna fall into a suit, I'd like to live in that fantasy world. But the truth is, I spotted some, you know, some beautiful women by the pool, and I was kind of trying to do this slow motion cool walk by the pool, and I'm dressed up quite nicely. I'm going to this formal event. And as I walk towards the pool and, you know, give this kind of sideways glance, kind of, you know, one of those ones. It was very sexy until I missed my step and walked directly into the pool. I'm not Jesus, so I couldn't walk across it. I just fell straight into it in my suit. I literally just dipped in slow motion into a pool. It was quite the visual. Yeah.
What was the reaction when you climbed out?
Everybody was really nice about it. They were overly, like, if anything, I would have felt less conscious if more people had just laughed it off. But more, everybody was like, oh my God, is this guy okay? Like, is he crazy? Has he got some deep rooted emotional problems? Like, what's going on? No, I was fine, mate. Everybody was quite nice about it. I was a bit embarrassed.
The big concern for me would be having my phone on me. Did you have your phone in your pocket?
I did. Luckily, it was in my jacket pocket, and it's waterproof, resistant, something. I don't know, whatever. But it's functioning. I mean, it seems to be still be working. So it worked out. I did have some very wet euros in my pocket, but that's okay. You know, like, there's a chap at a petrol station who didn't mind taking them, so it was fine.
Does it say something about where we're at as people, that if that was me in your shoes, slipping slowly into the pool, my first thought would be, I need to get my phone out of my pocket. I need to throw my phone to safety, because that's the bit that would terrify me the most. Not the potential humiliation of landing in the pool, but I don't want my phone to get wrecked. It's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I think I didn't think like that at the time. I just kind of, well, of course you fell into a pool, you moron. I just kind of accepted that this was, just very gracefully just sink into the water. It's fine. Like Skyler in Breaking Bad, you know, she just walks into the water and she doesn't even think about it. I felt a bit like that. And oddly enough, it was these weird pop culture references that were going through my mind when it was all going down. So, yeah.
You say you're a moron, but you're actually an incredibly talented moron, if nothing else. Like this is what I'm really excited to talk to you, Atif, because like you are a stand-up comedian who has been doing his thing for a good few years now. You are a cricket broadcaster for the Test Match Special, and you're a wrestling fan. Like there's so much to dig into, among many other things as well. But we're here because I feel like you don't get enough of an outlet to talk about your love of wrestling, and I get that because whenever I've heard you do interviews. You will get a wrestling reference in. So I feel like it's a part of you that is sort of bursting through the pockets. And we want to open it wide today, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I've loved wrestling since I was 7 years old. And, you know, like every wrestling fan, I kind of go through phases where I'm not super plugged into it, but it's always been there. I've never missed a WrestleMania. I've never missed a Rumble. Have I? I think I missed a couple of Rumbles in the 90s when my family couldn't afford Sky. But other than that, like I love wrestling. And the thing is, it's very difficult to talk about wrestling with people who don't know or like wrestling. So, but I try and do it. Like, I think there's these wonderful anachronisms in wrestling, and I like to bring that into my work, particularly in cricket commentary. Like, you know, it's really fun to say things like, you know, England are on top there. They are all over Pakistan like a cheap suit. And, you know, that's right out of a wrestling thing. I mean, it's this kind of thing that Jim Ross would say back in the day. I don't know, maybe he still says it. But I just think, and people really like these things as well. You know, they really like these things. Yeah, I mean, I love wrestling, man. And I don't like to sugarcoat it or pretend it or say like, oh, no, it's for my nephew. Or, oh, no, it's for, no, I really like it, man. I really enjoy it. And that's why it's really cool for me to be on this, because I've loved Cultaholic. I've been literally a day one Cultaholic follower. I was there from that weird promo where the clothes came off and they were like, it was just, yeah, I was there for that. I obviously followed Wild Culture Wrestling before that. Still see some of the videos from time to time, but I love Cultaholic. There's a few other channels I really like, and like my week isn't complete without a top 10 list or a news video, all that kind of stuff from you guys. So I really love it, you know, all of it.
We love you too, sir. And today you and I are going to be unapologetic wrestling fans for the next hour. Awesome. That's what we're going to do. And you're going to pick three wrestling matches to watch while stranded on a metaphorical desert island. What would you like your first match to be, Atif?
And by the way, it doesn't have to be a metaphorical desert island for me. I mean, last year I spent like 3 months in a bio bubble. So I couldn't leave this hotel in Southampton that we were kind of placed in during the England-Pakistan.
Really? So you spent three months in the bio bubble?
Well, okay, 3 months, slight exaggeration, but I was there for quite a while. It was a long time. I did at least 28 days in one place, and then 10 days in the other in the other hotel. So you're literally, you can't go anywhere. You watch the cricket, you talk about the cricket, you go back to your room. You can eat at a distance from everybody else. You can go to the bar and be at a distance from everybody else, and then you go back to your room. So what would I do? I'd watch wrestling, you know. And I'll tell you what my first match ever is, right? And it's interesting that we're talking about cricket, because my love for wrestling is kind of inexplicably tied into my love for cricket, because it happened at the same time. You know, I remember vividly the year was 1992. And 1992 was a big year for wrestling in my life, and it was a huge year for cricket as well. You know, I'm of Pakistani origin, so my team is Pakistan. And in 1992, Pakistan won the Cricket World Cup, and it was huge. And up until that moment, I didn't really understand what cricket was. I certainly didn't have a concept of what countries were, but I knew that, oh my, there's something about this team. I just love it. It was the color. It was the color of green, and it was like the way they played. I was like, yes, this is my team. Similarly, in 1992, I watched SummerSlam like everybody else in England, right? And I watched that Bulldog Bret Hart match, and you know, everybody was cheering for Bulldog, and you know, Bulldog was very cool, obviously. You know, love Davey Boy Smith, may he rest in peace. But there was something about the pink and black of Bret the Hitman Hart that, as a child, a 7-year-old kid, I look at it and I'm like, yes, that's my guy. That's my guy. Look at him. He looks so cool. That leather jacket, the way he wears it just off his shoulders. Oh, my goodness. That's what I want. Like, that's the guy that I want to be. That's the guy that I want to follow. The whole year just progressed. And this is a really long-winded way of telling you my first match, by the way. But
It's good.
I'm going to build it up to you, because it's not Bulldog and Bret Hart. It's not Bulldog and Bret Hart. I love that match. I watched the whole year. My first match, and this is really a surprise to a lot of people, is Bret Hart versus Ric Flair, which was on like a taped Superstars in 92. So in England, we got to see it on the Bret Hart VHS video, which I have. And I think they put a highlight, sort of like a shortened version of it, on the Superstars show that used to come on Sky. And I'll tell you why it was huge for me, Tom. It happened on my birthday, on my 8th birthday. The 12th of October, 1992 was the day Bret Hart won his first world title. I was already a huge fan, and I can't tell you. And the thing is, there's no internet out there. There's no phone, like, there's no way of knowing. There is no way I could know that Bret Hart is even about to challenge for the world title, never mind win it, because he did it just on a house show. It wasn't on pay-per-view. It wasn't on it was like just a taping in Saskatchewan. And, you know, I turn on my TV. It's like a surprise. It felt like it happened for me. You know, it felt like somebody was like, hey, Arthur, it's your birthday, so you made your favorite wrestler the world champion. Yay! And, I know it's not the most celebrated match of either wrestler. I know there's, like, all sorts of things going on around it. And Ric Flair is not a very in vogue person to talk about right now. But for me, like, I could watch that match over and over again, because it will always remind me of what it felt like on my 8th birthday. Every time I watch it, it's my 8th birthday again. Do you know what I mean?
That's what I love about wrestling, is that there are those intrinsic moments that are just hardwired to your life. And I love that it was Bret, who was one of your favorites, winning the title on your birthday. It's perfect. And it's, as you say, it connects to your love of cricket. You were drawn by the green for Pakistan. You were drawn by the pink for Bret Hart. With that match in particular, whilst it's not celebrated, it's a key point, because it's the beginning of what would sort of become the new generation of the WWF. And
yeah, it was.
Were you a fan during that? Because it's a weird era of wrestling to watch the new generation.
I know, I am, man. I know a lot of people have this kind of, oh, it was the dark days, and oh my word. But I like Doink the Clown. What was wrong with Doink the Clown? Why does everybody crap on Doink the Clown nowadays? Like, I mean, I don't know what the deal is.
I think we like bad guy Doink the Clown. I think it's when Vince went, hey, everybody's cheering him, let's make him a good guy. And you went, no, you've immediately, no. I think that's the bad guy Doink the Clown, I think, will always be superior to the good, like popping balloons with a cigar and stuff like that. That's the Doink we all want. It's an era that is very much dismissed, I do believe.
But I liked it, all of it. Like, you don't understand. I was so obsessed with all of it. Like, I mean, now in retrospect, it's really easy to think, oh, look how good the product was sort of 97 onwards, or this phase was really good, or the golden era and the attitude era, you know, Ruthless, whatever. Like, I really reflect on that time, and like, I really loved watching those matches. I loved watching all the jobber matches. You know, Papa Shango, people, oh, it was a terrible character. I love Papa Shango. It was one of my favorite characters. Like, I really wish they'd given it a proper run. I mean, as a child watching, it was terrifying. There was a sequence where he just set some enhancement talent's feet on fire. And I was watching this terror. I don't think I slept that night as a child, you know. But I really loved the character. And, you know, even people talk about the Godfather being his best character, I'm sure. Charles Wright liked The Godfather the most, but for me, Papa Shango was just an exceptional, underrated, underused character. So, I mean, everything from that character, that era, you know, the slightly hokey stuff, slightly cheesy stuff, I never minded it. I still look back on it quite fondly. I've still got a VHS tape from SummerSlam 93, and when I signed up to the WWE Network, one of the first things I did was watch SummerSlam 93 again, because that was a nostalgic favorite for me, you know what I mean? So I like that era. I think it gets a hard time.
What led you to find wrestling in the first place? We know that Bret Hart was your boy early on, but how did you discover it to begin with?
A kid in my primary school gave me a choke slam.
That's one way to discover it.
Yeah.
Which kid gave you the choke slam?
I don't remember his name.
I imagine he was a big lad. If he was doling out choke slams, he wouldn't have been a shrinking violet.
No, I remember we were sort of play fighting, but I think in my mind I was play fighting in the style of like some other cartoon, like a He-Man or like a Thundercats or like, I don't know, some kind of weird homoerotic thing that they fed kids at the time. So I mean we're having this kind of like fight, and then all of a sudden he just like picks me up with one hand, because he was a bigger kid, and just chucks me on the floor, and it really hurt as well. I remember vividly thinking like, what the hell, man? Like, why did you do that? And he did this, I think he was like, I don't know which wrestler at the time did the choke slam. I don't think it was associated with The Undertaker at the
time. It might have been Sid Justice at that point, maybe.
Possibly, yeah. It might have been Sid Justice. I remember he did that. I remember this same kid a few weeks later. I don't know if you remember Crush. His finishing move was where you just kind of squeeze someone's head. So, you know, and like this kid would do that. So, you know, like I was into the performative aspect of wrestling immediately. So I'm like, oh, we're performing. But no, this guy's like, I'm going to crush your head. And I just remember thinking like, damn. Like, because he did it. Obviously, this is way before the "Don't Try Me at Home" stuff got prominent. But it was the crushing of the head thing, and I was like, "Oh God, that's awful! How does this happen?" And then, you know, we didn't have a lot of channels at the time, but like on one of them, you had wrestling, and it's quite striking the first time you see it. You know, on TV. I think nowadays we live in a world of sensory overload. If you go back to the early 90s, like watching wrestling was like, you know, you've stepped into the colored world of the Wizard of Oz. It's crazy. So, I couldn't tell you. I think the first thing I ever saw was like the Ultimate Warrior against Rick Rude in some kind of recap show in England. But then I used to live on WWF Mania and Livewire and everything Todd Pettengill related. I was very excited to see him back recently, but it wasn't that great. Anyway, maybe nostalgia is better in your mind.
we do the classic Raw review here on the podcast feed, and so we're going through that new generation era, and Todd Pettengill he's a unique customer, because I think he's genuinely one of the, at that period of time, he's one of the best. But there's every so often we think like Vince McMahon just tells him to be cool. The one we watched the other week was he starts the In Your House report by going, "Hey, dudes and dudettes," and he says it without a shred of irony. And I swear to God, like three parts of me died, and everything that could curled back in on itself. And I think my penis dropped off. I'm not sure. Hard to tell. But it was the fact that it was just unironically stuff like that, but away from that, and to see him back recently doing In Your House again for NXT, it was a deep joy. It was a deep spice of nostalgia. Did anybody in your family get into wrestling as well? Was it just yourself?
No, it was just a solo endeavor for me. So I'm not an only child, but I'm like a late in life child, but like an older brother who's got 16 years on me, and an older sister who's got 18 years old on me. So they don't, like, they've never really taken an interest, or they'll vaguely be like, oh, so who's this and who's that? And, you know, never like disrespectful about it or anything like that, or never like judgy about it, but they never got into it. There was for a while, my nephew got really into it. Nephew's 15 now, and when he was sort of five, I got him into wrestling a little bit. I'd take him to the shows. We even went to meet CM Punk at Hamley's. No, it wasn't Hamley's. Was it Hamley's? It was Hamley's, I think it was. Oh, it was Harrods. Sorry, Harrods in London. So I told my nephew to me, he was a huge fan. So we went over there, and he got to meet him, and he was really happy. But then eventually he kind of lost interest in modern wrestling, and now he only watches cricket. But that's cool, because I can introduce him to people like Jimmy Anderson as well. So, you know.
There you go. You can use your connections again there to be the cool uncle.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, sadly, the wrestling thing left him. But I discovered there's like a whole group of people, you know, my age roughly, who really like wrestling. So you know, I'm on a WhatsApp group that's constantly pinging wrestling related stuff and, you know, wrestling related videos and concepts and ideas and fantasy booking and retrospective debates. And you know, it's like there's a whole YouTube channel just living on my WhatsApp. And I love sort of dipping in and out there, but you know, it's all of a sudden, it's a really exciting time for wrestling again in the present. So I'm sure we'll talk about that when we talk about the next match.
You do a lot of stuff through the BBC and yeah. You do a lot of stuff on the comedy circuit as well. Is there anybody that we would be surprised to find out is a big wrestling fan?
Who would surprise you? Oh, well, there's a comedian called Jamali Maddox. Who does a lot of stuff in Europe and America. He's like an international name now, right after Taskmaster and things like that. He loves wrestling. He's really into it. I remember at the Edinburgh Fringe, we'd be there. And at the Edinburgh Fringe, nobody talks about anything other than comedy because it's like, you know, it's like a battlefield, you know. But we'll randomly be sitting in the bar of some venue and we'll just end up talking about wrestling for a couple of hours. And, you know, it's really... Jamali Maddox is really into it. I don't know who else would surprise you per se, but I do keep bumping into people who like wrestling, or they'll do a wrestling reference and you kind of look at each other and then you do the other reference and you look at each other and you're like, you know, we're part of that. Okay, you and me, yeah? Okay.
Nudge, wink.
Yeah, so we all know each other when we see each other. But yeah, off the top of my head, I can't think of it. But Jamali Maddox is the one that surprised me initially. And basically, every American comedian that comes to the UK seems to like wrestling, or at least be overtly aware of it. I think there were people like Patrice O'Neill, comedians in America, who made it very cool to like wrestling, and Bill Burr liked it as well. So I think Bill Burr did the Steve Austin podcast a couple of years ago. And, you know, since then, a lot of these comics have seen overlaps between the wrestlers and their lifestyle because it's very similar. Yeah, other than the bumps, obviously. You travel, you do a gig, you go to a hotel, you travel, you go to a gig, you do a hotel, you know, you do that in sequence. And sometimes, you know, all the same things are there, like, you know, addiction issues and, you know, temptations to do this and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there are a lot of overlaps. I think comics see that. So you'll often find comics who are big wrestling fans.
You said in an interview a few years back, and I'm pretty sure you've said it since, the dream job for you, despite all the stuff that you do, the dream job is head writer for WWE.
I think I was slightly tongue-in-cheek about it. I'd love to do it, Tom. I'd love to do it, Tom. Don't get me wrong. But since then, I've come across people like yourself, like Adam Pacitti, like all these guys who know so much and have really informed takes that I can be humble and step back and say, maybe I'm not the right guy for this. Like, maybe there's other people who are better qualified.
You know what? Here's the thing, though, Atif. You're probably the more right guy than any of us. And I'll tell you for why. They are so keen to have people that aren't, like, whilst you are a wrestling fan, like, your world is in everything other than that. Like, they would be more inclined to bring in people from like the entertainment sector and the comedy sector and other sports sectors than wrestling fans. And I kind of get it why they wouldn't want to bring certain smelly wrestling fans into the writing room. I totally get it. Myself included there. Smell quite nice today, but that's beside the point. I totally get it. They would want people with a field of vision that goes outside of wrestling. So I would say arguably you say, oh, I don't think I'd be qualified. I think you'd probably be more qualified than we would.
Well, I don't know. I think I don't know about qualified in that, because I guess more sort of with the weird kind of parameters they have, a little bit more desirable for that role. But like, I mean, look, I'd love to do that. I think I do have a flair for storytelling. I mean, I've written TV shows, you know, I've written on TV shows and I've created shows. So, I mean, I've got that skill set. But it is a really, really specialist role. And the more insight we get, like now, Tom, I mean, we live in a world where we have unprecedented insight into wrestling with all of these podcasts and wrestlers. And, you know, behind the scenes, you got Bruce Pritchard. And I love the Bruce Pritchard podcast, right? I can't live without something to wrestle with. That's like my favorite thing. Okay. I, you know, the level of insight you get you really appreciate the struggle, like the hustle to write the thing, to make last minute changes, the lifestyle changes. You know, I've listened, I love Jim Cornette and Vince Russo. You know, I love both of them, despite, you know, a lot of people that, oh, I hate Vince Russo. I kind of love both of them. They both helped create this amazing ecosystem in the world of wrestling. You know, some people would accuse them of other things, but that's okay. I like the insight they've given me into this world. And you know, I've been very lucky to get a lot of cool followers on Twitter over the years, Tom. But one of my absolute most proud moments was when I got a follow and a retweet from Jim Cornette. I was like, now I've made it. You know, never mind all these, like, the world number one cricket player at the time, or never mind this legendary that person, or this comedian or that person, Jim Cornette, and that made my day. So I really respect what they've had to do, man, to do it. And I'd love to do it, obviously, don't get me wrong, but I just think I recognize that it's a stretch.
I do hear what you're saying. I want to talk a bit more about the stuff that you do after your second match. So we have so far, we're filling out your DVD. We have a beauty between Bret Hart and Ric Flair. It was the night that Bret Hart became the WWE champion for the very first time. Atif, what would you like your second match to be?
It would be Bret Hart versus... No, I'm kidding. I did have the instinct.
It's Bret Hart all the way down.
I did have the instinct. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine called Armand just before, when you very kindly invited me to this podcast. And I was like, I've got to think of my three favorite matches. He's like, why don't you just say the matches at King of the Ring 93? Because then all three of them could be Bret matches.
Do you know what? And, they were all good matches as well.
They were all good 93. Matches. They were all good matches. Again, another great pay-per-view, and another great example of why, you know, in my opinion, of all the workers I have, so I think this is just the greatest. I still think he's, you know, like, I've never been as invested in the mechanics of a wrestling match as when Bret was doing it. And the only person who evoked that emotion is the guy in my, you know, close to that emotion is the guy in my second match. So the second match, right, is Randy Orton versus Batista. Versus Daniel Bryan, right? That's WrestleMania night, WrestleMania 30. I don't know if I'm not supposed to number them anymore, but WrestleMania 30 it was. It was amazing because I really wanted it. Like, I haven't really wanted anything in wrestling for a long time. You know, you watch anything, oh, this might happen, that might happen. Oh, this guy, yeah, you know, I reckon he'll win and he'll get the IC belt and he'll get this. And you watch it quite cynically, you know, and you watch it quite like an informed insider, a smark, whatever, right? You watch it like that. When that match was happening, Tom, I really wanted Daniel Bryan to win. I wanted it so badly. And you know, it was such an emotional night because, you know, The Undertaker just lost, and he looked so mortal at the end of that game. Like, he didn't look like, you know, this mythical figure anymore. He looked, because he was concussed, obviously. So he looked really out of it, and everybody's still recovering from that. And then you got Daniel Bryan coming out, and he's got the, I remember he had like the, those funky fur, fake fur boots on, and that tape around his wrist. And I was like, oh, it just looks a bit unsightly. Like, that's not how I want to see him lifting the belt. But it was just so inspiring. Like, the whole, the way he everything that built up to that moment, you know, it was just like, and you know, WWE have a track record of not giving you, you know, that golden moment sometimes. Like, if you look at, you know, Booker T and Triple H, and there's so many countless main events, right, where they just went, no, that's not what we're going to do. They gave it to us for Daniel Bryan. It was just magic. Like, it was the most satisfying conclusion to a WrestleMania for me since Mania 10. So,
it's,
yeah.
Interesting build-up to that match as well, because there's a big part of you, a big part of me that even to this day goes, I don't think they wanted to do that. I don't think they wanted Daniel Bryan anywhere near there, but they got to a point where they go, if he's not, the fans will probably sandbag the whole night. So we kind of have to do it. And it's, they will since say, oh, you know, they'll, in interviews and stuff, they've gone, yeah, but was that really what we were going to do? Sure. Are you sure that this wasn't the plan all along? And I'm still going, yeah, I'm pretty sure this wasn't the plan all along. But they'll try and sort of retroactively own it as, this was the greatest story we ever told, pal. But I don't think that was the case. Are you of a similar mindset that wasn't what they wanted to do that night?
Absolutely. They had no idea. That was never going to happen. They didn't foresee that segment happening where they'd have every world champion that was alive and in proximity standing in a ring and everybody in the crowd would chant for Daniel Bryan. I mean, when you think about it, you got like Shawn Michaels was there, Bret Hart was there, you know, Mark Henry, Orton, Cena, Triple H, all these huge names are in the ring, right? And everybody's going Daniel Bryan nonstop, like to the point where they have to acknowledge it. It's incredible. They did not see that happening. They did not see people getting right behind this guy. I don't even think Daniel Bryan saw people getting behind him in that way. And it was just really cool to see fans like actually informing the booking, because they did inform the booking in that way. They were like, geez, what do we do? We just gotta give it to them. And he deserved it. He really, really deserved it. You really felt happy for him. He's a cool guy. I've enjoyed following him on social media, actually, because, like, you know, he seems like a cool guy. And and when he did his first promo on AEW, I found it slightly jarring when he swore, actually,
because surprise, isn't it?
Yeah, he's like a cherub boy. He's not allowed to swear. But yeah, no, it was quite jarring when I saw that. I know it was not a televised promo, but even so. But yeah, I love Daniel Bryan. I think he's so cool. I like what he stands for outside of wrestling as well. That match, it just made me really happy. And I was a full grown adult by then. You know, I wasn't this 8-year-old kid. I was like 29, I think, when that happened. So that match to make me that happy at that time of the night, it was something ridiculously late as I walked home. I remember I watched it with some friends in Great Portland Street, and then I walked back home and I was like, I'm so happy. And like, just for the happiness of that match evoked, it's got to be my Desert Island Graps.
So you were on your way back from some friend's house. So where were you sort of life-wise at this point? I just say an older man than you were when you watched Bret Hart, high as a kite watching Daniel Bryan win the big one. Are we into the comedy world at this point? Are we making headway there?
Yeah, I mean, I made very slow headway in the comedy world. I started stand up when I was sort of 21, and I started as sort of just for fun, really, because I trained to be an actor. I wanted to be an actor. But I mean, I wasn't getting anything. I remember my agent telling me at the time, like, oh, you're not going to get a lot of stuff. I'm like, why? He's like, well, you're not quite tall enough to be tall, but you're not short enough to be short. You're not good looking enough to be good looking, but you're not bad looking enough to be character-y. You're not fat enough to be fat. You're not thin enough to be thin. So and you don't look Asian enough to look Asian. And you certainly don't look white enough to look white. So you fall in this awful cross section where people who want to cast stuff aren't going to like you. I love that honesty. So I remember him telling me that, and I thought, oh, this will be funny. I'm going to use that on stage somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you obviously turned, I was going to say, what do you do with that information? But, you know, as a stand-up comedian, that becomes fuel, doesn't it? That's fuel for the fire, and it writes 15 minutes of a show pretty much when that happens. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I started doing stand-up at 21, and I was pretty ordinary / awful for, I like to think about 7 years. So I was very lucky. A lot of great clubs gave me the opportunity to develop my work. I was emceeing at this place called The Alchemist in Clapham Junction for like 3 years. Every Wednesday and Friday, I'd be emceeing the show there. And that gave me the opportunity to like just, you know, keep learning the craft and developing and to have that stage time to get better, 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 better. And have access to great comedians as well who give you notes and ideas and things like that. And it was really 2016 where I sort of had my breakthrough year when I did my first really big Edinburgh Fringe show that got good reviews and stuff. So, yeah, it took me ages to make headway in the comedy world. But it was all bubbling away in the background. I think professionally I was kind of bouncing about when that happened. So, you know, it's not a big stretch to say at that point in my life, it might have been the coolest thing that had happened in that month.
Who's Alex Newdman?
How did you find that?
I did my research, friend.
Oh my God. Okay. So unbelievable. So when I started doing stand-up comedy, I had a job with like a really high profile tech company. And I was worried that the kind of things I wanted to say on stage wouldn't resonate well with this company. So I thought I need a pseudonym I was pretty filthy. I mean, my early inspirations were like, you know, just comics were quite outwardly rude and things like that. And it didn't suit me, but that's what I went with in the early days. So I decided to call myself Alex Nudeman because I'm very fond of being nude. I'm a man, and Alex is slightly easier to spell than Atif. So I thought, okay, great, we'll go with Alex Nudeman. So that was my pseudonym when I started doing stand-up comedy, and I thought I'd buried it, but you found it, Tom. Somehow you found it.
Because you can always say that, you know, that Atif Nawaz has had an incredible career in comedy, but you can always say that Alex Nudeman, he didn't really cut the mustard. Yeah. Because all the stuff that you kind of were figuring out, trying new stuff, so it doesn't come back on your other job, on your shoot job, it all falls to Alex Nudeman. He can deal with it.
Can I just say how unbelievably flattering it is? Because I've been interviewed like so many times. Nobody's ever brought that up.
Really?
Nobody's ever really brought up Alex. Not for the last 5 years. You know, and like, yeah, it's unbelievably flattering that you'd go through the effort to do that level of research on me.
Island. I've got to do a background check on you.
I feel very special
for immigration purposes. For Cultaholic Island, everybody gets a background check before they get on the island.
I'm very familiar with immigration checks, so that's cool. But
tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm desperate to know how you got involved with Test Match Special, which for those who live outside of England, outside of Britain, don't know, like it's an institution for cricket fans is the BBC Test Match Special. Like it has an iconic bit of theme music. The moment, I must admit, before you and I sat down today, knowing I'm doing this, I'm walking around the office going... because you just do, it's there. It's ingrained in your brain. But how did you come to go from becoming a cricket fan, falling in love with Pakistan and the green colours, to working as part of Test Match Special? And I want to ask as well, because so many people get in touch with me who say, like, I want to try and... you know, do more work in the entertainment industry, in television, in radio and whatever. And it's always great to hear other perspectives. So how did you get involved, sir?
So I used to do some commentary for a group called Test Match Sofa, which was like this like alternative commentary thing. Like if you imagine like Cultaholic watches, it's almost like a watch along. They were doing watch alongs before watch alongs were a thing, and you know, we would do that and you just mess about and it was just silly and you'd make jokes and be like, you know, you'd swear and it would all be very funny and all that kind of stuff. So I did that for a long time, I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't like a professional thing. I was just doing it for fun, but everybody knew that I loved cricket. Everybody knew that I love cricket, and slowly as my profile increased in the world of comedy, you know, get on TV and people see you all of a sudden, like, who's this guy? What do we know about this guy? People start looking up the Alex Nudeman days, all that stuff, right? So all of a sudden people, you know, I'm getting a bit of notoriety, and Isha Guha, who was at one stage the world number one bowler, a World Cup winner for England, is a really good friend. And she was told by the BBC that they wanted her to do a podcast. And so she called me, and I remember this. I was in Ireland watching Pakistan-Ireland, which was Ireland's first ever test match. I don't know why I do these things, but anyway, I was in Malahide watching this test match by myself. So I'm watching the game. I'm back. I'm at the airport. I get this voicemail from Isha, and she's like, call me when you can. I call her, and she's like, hey, I've been offered this podcast. Give me some ideas and stuff. So I'm giving her some ideas because she's my friend. Why wouldn't I? And she says, you know what? Why don't you just do this with me? I said, I can't do a podcast for the BBC. And then I was like, yes, I can. Yeah, totally. I'll do a podcast for the BBC. That's cool. And then we got a third chap called Ankur Desai on, and the three of us formed what became known as the Dusra, BBC Dusra. That was the podcast. And they really liked it. It was really well reviewed. Everybody who listened to really enjoyed it. I mean, I tried to be quite true to my comic self and told jokes and made it quite light and all that kind of stuff. And they really liked it. It was really fresh compared to some of the cricket coverage that was out there at the time. And eventually they discovered I'm a lifelong fan of Middlesex County Cricket Club. That's my local team and county, and I've been watching them my whole life. I've commentated for them as well because they thought of me as a celeb in hashtag in inverted commas. So they bring me on as like a celebrity Middlesex fan to commentate. And I loved it because, like, you know, you get to watch the game for free. You get a free mushroom soup and some free bread and a little bit of biscuits. Like, what more do you want from life, right? So I was happy. And then, yeah, eventually the producer at TMS said to me, you know, we'd like you to commentate for us. And I was like, cool, what do you want me to commentate? And he said, the IPL. And I was like, oh, dude, I'm not going to get a visa to India. And he was like, no, we're going to do it from London. And, you know, he explained it to me. And I was like, okay, cool. So we'll do the IPL from London. Then we did the same thing with the Big Bash. And then eventually they were ready. They were like, right, we want you to make a test match debut. We want you to be on commentary for England versus Pakistan. We think that's quite fitting because, you know, you love Pakistani cricket. You've got that insight there. And, you know, it'll be your first test match and it'll be at Southampton. Oh, by the way, you're going to be in a bio bubble for a month. But, you know, that's the way it's got to be. And it was incredible, man. Like, a bunch of things had to converge for it to happen. And now I feel like the luckiest person in the world. Like, if I could go back to my younger self and tell myself that one day I will have this pass, and this pass I will wear around my neck, and it will give me access to any cricket match I want in the country for the whole summer. Oh my goodness. You know, I mean, that's like, imagine if money in the bank could be used 30 times a year, right? Like, that's how good the feeling is. Like, you've got a chance to go to see everything as often as you want, and you have the best seat in the house, and you've got the most privileged access, and people want to talk to you. Like, some days I feel like I won the lottery, man. It was unbelievable. What a gig. Amazing.
How was that day calling England Pakistan on commentary? Because, as you say, lifelong fan of Pakistan, a massive match in the IPL, and it's a big part of the BBC cricket coverage. Like, what goes through your head in the build up to that?
I was doing insane amounts of research, which were rendered useless almost instantly by Andy Zaltzman, because I'd put all these stats together. Andy Zaltzman is another stand-up comedian who's the scorer. I think that's his official title, but he's actually just really funny and contributes really cool things to the Test Match special program. So anyway, as I walked in, I had this brown leather notebook, which I thought would look cool as well. It was very important because everybody told me, like, listen, this is a Test Match special. You know, this is like 45-year-old white people. Like, you know, you got to make sure you fit in here, right? Like, you got to be a bit more, look academic and stuff. I was like, okay, well, I was like, oh, I'm going to be me. I'm not going to think about that too much. But I did buy into the whole, like, look a little bit. So, I put a shirt on, like an actual shirt with buttons. You know, I tucked it into the trousers that I was wearing, and I wore shoes, like actual shoes, not trainers, not Yeezys, not any of the fancy trainers I like to wear day to day. I put on shoes, and I walk into the room with my leather notebook filled with notes, and Andy Zaltzman hands me the sheet with all the information I need anyway, better formatted than I could ever hope to do in my life. And it just made me chuckle. And then I remember I got on mic, and Ebony Rainford Brent was with me, and I'll forever love her because she made it so easy for me my first stint. She knew I was a bit nervous, and I was, it was a big moment for me. And she guided me through it while giving me the space to bask in the moment. you know what I mean? Like, it's a bit like in wrestling, you know, the insight we get is like the one wrestler calls the action, right? And the other person follows. You have like a leader and the other person follows, right? And if you're lucky, the person who's guiding you in that match will give you moments to shine, right? Will give you your moments to do your spots, so to speak. And Ebony was the perfect dance partner in that moment because she gave me the space to say everything that I needed to, I wanted to. She let my personality come out, and you know, I'll forever love her for that. And yeah, it was an amazing thing, man. I can't even tell you. I felt so privileged, and all the love starts pouring in on social media, and I was really universal. Like, I remember just feeling so overwhelmed because, like, I must have had, like, for me, it was a lot. It felt like thousands and thousands of tweets. It probably wasn't that many, but it felt like that. And they were all complimentary. And I just went to bed with a big smile on my face, and I was really happy. And yeah, it was a great day, man. Maybe probably in the top 10 days of my life, the first day I did TMS.
I want to compare this because I know you spoke to a lot of guys in the wrestling world. You've done a fair few interviews with folks on carpets and stuff. Who's been your favorite wrestling star to meet? And who has been your favorite cricket star to meet?
A cricket star, very easy, Wasi Makram. He is very funny. He was one of the greatest of all time, obviously, arguably the greatest of all time. And I got to hang out with him for a long time, to the point where we exchanged WhatsApp messages now, which blows my mind. But anyway, yeah, him. Also, I really like Ian Bell and Mark Ramprakash as well. Like, from England, they were two of my favorite people to hang out with. It was so much fun. Mark Ramprakash will play table tennis with you all day long and still give you dad energy. Like, it's just like, this guy won Strictly Come Dancing, right? And he's just like the most humble person in the room. He's just such a lovely guy. And Ian Bell is just, he's just a great, he's just really lovely. I've been very lucky, Tom. I like everybody I met in the cricket world. I've never met a guy and thought, huh, what a loser. Like, I've genuinely never thought that. I've met just a sequence of lovely people. Anyway, wrestling people. Again, I got very lucky. I got to meet a lot of these people doing some of these like press events and red carpet events and VIP parties and all these weird things. I remember being most impressed by James Storm. So I remember I met him and Bobby Roode, and Bobby Roode was a bigger star at the time, probably now still is. But I remember James Storm being really funny, really clever, and he did us a magic trick. The camera wasn't on; he did this magic trick for us anyway, and he liked to play along. And you know, I'm trying to have fun. I'm trying to make it a comedic interview. Like, I really enjoyed chatting to Drew McIntyre as well, or Drew Galloway as he was at the time, and Bobby Lashley. They were both really lovely, and they made it easy to have that jokey interplay. But I just remember James Storm being the most entertaining. I just really ran. I should have picked the most famous person. But if I'm really honest, like,
no, I get it.
McIntyre and
we had James Storm on this show a couple years back, and he's lovely, and I met him at a Defiant show about a year before that. Even then, he was a smashing soul. There was a really lovely story which we talked about on the podcast with him. Out of interest, when you spoke to Bobby Lashley, did he genuinely go out into town with the TNA title on or not? Because I feel like he said it as like, yeah, I'll definitely do that. I'll go and get ice cream and wear the TNA title around London. Did he actually do it or not?
Again, mind blowing that you did that level of research. And like, I can't believe you went, like, most people just glance at the Wikipedia page, Tom. You've like done a full on like,
amateur.
You should work for the UK government, man. Like, that level of research is insane. We need you. What are you doing in wrestling? Well, you go save the world, man. Like, anyway, I don't think he did that. But he was really lovely, and he was really nice. He let me hold his belt as well and take a photo with it, which was really nice.
He's like a good egg. Now, we've got one more match to get to before we do. As well as taking three wrestling matches, you're also allowed to take with you, I like to spring this on people at it, you're also allowed to take with you a movie, an album, and a luxury item. So when I say to you, you can take a movie with you onto the island, what movie springs to mind?
Pulp Fiction, but it's not the one I would take.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So Pulp Fiction sprung to mind. It comes to mind as like if people ask me the question, it's like, "Oh, is your favorite movie?" I'd say Pulp Fiction. I really like it. I know it's unfashionable to like it now, but I still like it. I went to this event a few weeks ago, and there was a silent auction, and I was really hoping not to win it, but I did win it. I've got this signed poster frame of John Travolta signing the poster. I've got it, but like I've got nowhere to put it, but I've got it, and I paid an extortionate amount for it as well. So if anybody wants it, get in touch. But just bring your checkbook. So do people have checkbooks anymore? Anyway, I would say Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. That's the film I would take with me. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. That's like my all-time happy movie. Like I'm thinking Desert Island, all these things I have in common, but everything I choose are things that make me happy. So Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is such a great movie. If you've not seen it, I highly recommend it. Steve Martin, Michael Caine, Frank Oz directed it. It's just comedic genius.
Great shout. How about an album? What album would you take?
I think the second or third Britney album. No, I would take, even they were both great, great albums. No. I think I would take The Prodigy, The Fat of the Land. Again.
But you'll be thinking of Britney.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a song on there called Breathe, isn't there? I really love The Fat of the Land. It's the first CD I ever bought. Was The Fat of the Land by The Prodigy, and at the time there's a song on there called Funky Shit, and it was just really cool to hear the word shit in a song. Mm-hmm. You know, I was that age where, oh my god, he said shit. Oh, did you hear that? He said shit. Oh my days, man. He said shit.
You're
so like, it was,
swear words. Was Fat of the Land had Firestarter on? Because I'm all right thinking Fat of the Land's the album with the scorpion on the front cover.
Yes, yeah,
that's the one, isn't it? Yeah, it is.
So it had Breathe, it had Smack My Bitch Up, it had Firestarter, it had Minefield. It was just wall to wall, just classic track. Diesel Power, that Diesel Power, incidentally, somehow came bang in line with Diesel's Rain. I think that album came out in 94, if I'm not wrong. So yeah,
just as Diesel was sort of catching on, like, there was never a collaboration effort there.
That's what he needed. That's what Diesel needed, was like a WrestleMania entrance where the Prodigy performed.
That and less shit writing, and he would have been fine.
Yeah, so that's the album I would take. There we go.
And how about a luxury item, sir? So something that hasn't got to have, like, it hasn't got to be useful. It can just be an item with some personal significance or some sentimental value. It can be a bit of tech. It can be a gadget or something like that. What would spring to mind as a luxury item?
I think I'd want to take something cricket related, but I'm going to just say my Super Nintendo.
Amazing choice. Best game on the Super Nintendo.
For me, Super Mario World.
Good shout. Yeah. That's a classic.
Yeah, I like the Mario games. I think Super Mario 3 on the NES is probably the best overall Mario game, but Super Mario World is really fun too. I really love that. So yeah.
Mario World felt really special because it's all of a sudden the graphics got like twice as good.
And
you had you could ride a dinosaur in it. I remember my mind was blown when I played.
Yeah,
I was like, I really want to zoom in. No.
But I did miss. But I think there were things in Mario 3 that were better. You know, I think there were things like the Tanuki suit and, you know, turning into a statue, and it was really, it's just, it was that jump, right? So Super Mario 1 and 2 doesn't count, right? Because it's not part of the. I mean, it's not really canon. So it was Super Mario 1, and then you go to 3, and it was like the most creative engineering ever. Like the ideas just burst. So I really love Super Mario 3. And I thought, well, obviously World looks incredible, but the level of, it was like going from iPhone 4 to iPhone 5, right? iPhone 4 was a genuine leap and iPhone 5 was an incremental leap. So that's the way I look at, I don't use an iPhone instead. I don't know why I use that as an analogy, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean.
That's a good shout. I like that a lot. Let's see your third and final match then. I see if we've had Bret versus Flair for the WWF title from back in the day. And we had our second match, which was, it wasn't anything from King of the Ring, and it wasn't another Bret Hart match. Why has it fallen out of my head? Of all the things, what was your second match? Remind me.
Triple Threat, WrestleMania, Daniel Bryan.
Batista at all. He was injured. It was a weird look. The furry boots. He won the title. It was a good day. They pretended to write it. That's what it was. Your third and final match then, friend. What would you like it to be?
So again, I thought about this and, like, you know, honorable mention to CM Punk, whose various of matches I really enjoyed, particularly against John Cena at Money in the Bank, but I didn't pick that one. I picked Hiroshi Tanahashi versus Kazuchika Okada at Wrestle Kingdom 9.
Wow. So, okay, they've had some clashes over the years, but why Tanahashi Okada from 9 out of all of them? Yeah.
That was in 2015. So I didn't know much about Japanese wrestling. All I knew is what I'd read in a magazine called Power Slam that I used to collect as a kid, right? And shout out to Finlay Martin, what a guy.
All my wrestling news for many years was Power Slam magazine. It was a deep joy to pick
I
that
still,
up. Finn Martin I got still, very angry near the end, did you find? I found that near the end of the run, he seemed to really hate wrestling.
Yeah, I think it was a thankless endeavor for him, but he was a true wrestling fan, because I would email him from time to time with, like, random questions about wrestling. So me and my friends would have these debates, like, who was the bigger draw, Brett or Sean? And I'd be oh, obviously it's Brett, and then it's Sean, and, like, the only person who can definitively tell you the answer for us that might reply is Finlay Martin, and he would always reply, he'd always take the time to reply and stuff, and I always thought he's a lovely, really, really, really lovely man. And
Did we ever find out on the subject with Power Slam? Apologies for interrupting whilst it's in my brain. Did we ever find out the identity of Stately Wayne Manor? He was the American columnist who was had this really kind of acidic column every month, and he went under the pen name Stately Wayne Manor. I just don't know whether we ever found out who he was.
Well, it's a really good pen name. It was better than Vic Venom, which is what Vince Russo
almost
went
as good as Alex Nudman.
Yeah, I think I might do that. I might start a cricket podcast with a distorted voice and just call myself Alex Nudman.
Yes,
and just say controversial things. But we've given it away now. Never mind. I didn't know anything about Japanese wrestling other than what I was fed by Power Slam, kind of growing up, right? So I vaguely knew who Shinya Hashimoto was, who Kenta Kobashi was. So I vaguely knew about these people because I'd read Power Slam, but I'd never seen them. You can't see Japanese wrestling in England unless you're like a tape trader. I never got into tape trading. So I think Wrestle Kingdom 9 was the first kind of widely available pay-per-view. I think it was promoted by somebody. It was like GWF or somebody had promoted it in the UK, so you could buy it as a pay-per-view and watch it in England legally, right? So the first time my friends and I, we sat down to watch a New Japan pay-per-view, and Jim Ross was on commentary for it as well. So this is the first time they got Jim Ross to commentate on a New Japan pay-per-view, and it just blew our minds. It was the first time we saw Shinsuke Nakamura. It was the first time we saw Kota Ibushi. Kenny Omega, a much younger Kenny Omega at the time, was on the lower undercard at the time. I think he was the junior heavyweight champion, IWGP junior, yeah, whatever. Junior so he was like, he's wearing their version of light heavyweight, right? So he had that belt, and, you know, Jushin Liger and all these great people. Like, it was really cool. So I remember I used to get really excited when Jushin Liger would randomly pop onto WCW or WWE TV. And it was, you know, I just to watch that paper, it was really great fun. And it was really long. Like, it was such a long show. It was like 4.5 hours or something. It felt crazy long. And the matches were really absorbing and long as well. So we've just seen Shinsuke Nakamura versus Kota Ibushi. We're like, wow, that might be the best wrestling match we've ever seen. Nothing can top that. Shall we just stop? What's the point watching another match? Well, it's the world title match. Okay, fine, what the hell? And as Kazuchika Okada comes out, Hiroshi Tanahashi come out, and they have what, to my memory, is probably the best match I've ever seen. You know, I haven't seen all of the Omega Okada matches. I've seen some of them. But, like, that match was so good. Like, it made me really appreciate the craft of wrestling again. Like, again, you know, it goes back to Bret Hart. I remember. All of these things are embedded in my mind. You know, elbow off the top rope, off the middle rope. Sorry, elbow off the middle rope, side Russian leg sweep, you know, leg drop, elbow drop, and then the sharpshooter, right? You know his sequence. Like, his sequence is very clear. So, you know, oh, inverted atomic drop, by the way. I forgot. You got an inverted atomic drop. So, anyway, like, I didn't, in the middle somewhere, you know, with the Attitude Era and the Stone Cold Steve Austin and the brawling and all that kind of stuff. I loved all that stuff, don't get me wrong. But I lost interest slash appreciation for the craft of wrestling, you know, the actual what's happening in the squids. It became more about the promos and the moments and the title changes and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I never watched a match and appreciated the work in the ring as much as I did with Tanahashi and Okada. So I would watch that again. That was the first match that really got me into Japanese wrestling. Now I kind of try and follow it reasonably closely. It's been tough over the pandemic, obviously, but I try and follow it. I just think it's very cool. They're revolutionaries. They had the idea to make Wrestle Kingdom over 2 days, way before WrestleMania did it. They've just announced they're going to do it over 3 days. I'm waiting for a three-day wrestle. I'm just waiting for when WrestleMania just becomes a month of the year. You know, that's what I'm waiting for.
I am very happy with the decision to make WrestleMania 2 nights again.
Yeah,
I'm very happy with that. As somebody that reports on it, like if I've got the choice between 3 hours on a Saturday night, 3 hours on a Sunday night, over 7.5 hours on a Sunday night, I'm going to take the 2 nights. That'll be fine. I can sleep a little bit on both nights and not have what we used to have, this sort of WrestleMania malaise where like you'd be up from midnight till 6 a.m. I remember seeing WrestleMania 34, I think it was. I was at a WrestleMania party in Leeds and we did a wrestling show just before it. And then we went to this party and my partner texted me at 6:30 in the morning. She was like, "Good morning," to which I just sent her back a picture of my pint saying, "Morning." She said, why are you still drinking? I said, "The show hasn't finished yet."
Wow.
It was just mayhem. I'm so happy it's 2 nights. I'm so happy.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think most fans are with you as well. To be honest with you, I like the one night, 4 hour tops. The formula, I like that. I think 2 nights, maybe it's because now I have more obligations and I have to do other things, so it's really hard to take 2 nights out to watch it. But I did like that old school idea of like you gotta make it onto that card. You don't just get to be on the card, you gotta make it on that card. I like that old school idea of like, you know, only the really really important feuds get their blow-offs there, or the big match, or the big, you know, like it's a big thing, right? So but yeah, I mean, also really happy to have 2 nights of it. I don't like that this sort of displaced the NXT show, the Two Night Mania and the Hall of Fame. Like
I think it might be NXT. I mean, they might do what they did this year. They might do a 2 night takeover, Wednesday, Thursday, Hall of Fame Friday, WrestleMania night 1 night, 2 Saturday, Sunday. It might be another one of those weeks where just as my partner says, she becomes a widow to wrestling for the week. my sleep pattern is buggered and I'm at work all the time, but it's not a bad job at all. As you say, though, it's difficult when you have other obligations that mean you don't get to enjoy it as much as you could. One of those obligations is you're back on the road touring again. Comedy is back. Yeah. You're back out there. Atif, tell me one thing that you missed from doing stand-up that you didn't think you would miss?
Insulting people. I didn't. It's not so much insulting people, right? Like I very rarely get hecklers. I think my reputation is that I'm a nice guy and a good storyteller. So this is what people, I think if there's any nice things they say about, oh, he's a good, nice guy, he's a good storyteller. So people buy into my stories. When I'm in a club, they're like, okay, this will be fun. But I do still have that original instinct in me to just, you know, when somebody's being rude or they're just chatting or doing anything that, you know, pisses me off, I'm going in. Like, I'm going to rinse you. Like, this is it. It's happening. I was in Manchester on Sunday at the Frog and Bucket Comedy Club, which is a great club, by the way. So if you're in Manchester looking for stand-up, it's a great place to go. There was a lady there. And we had a little, it's very hard to recreate the moment now for you, but we had a little bit of an interplay which resulted in me making fun of her and everybody kind of laughed and it was fine. And after the show, I always go and make a point of like, listen, are you okay? I was just messing about. It's just a show. And 9 out of 10 times they're fine. And the 10th time, I don't really care as much. So it was a really lovely feeling when the crowd is with you. You know, when you take on one person and the crowd is behind you, again, it's just like wrestling. You're the face. You're worried if you're about to do something heelish as a face, but they're behind you when you do the heel thing. So you know, that it's a really good feeling. Like that, I really miss that. I miss that more than I thought. So it's pretty cool.
Where can people go to find out where you're going to be next?
Okay, so this is where I get to plug myself.
Absolutely, sir. Go for it.
Not a euphemism. If you like, on Twitter is a good place because like I usually pin on Twitter my upcoming gigs. Now I've got a bunch between now and the end of November, and then December I think I'm going to be on some kind of tour, but I don't know that officially yet. But yeah, I'm going to be all over the place. I know I'm going to be in Wolverhampton and Birmingham and Leamington Spa, Manchester, Glasgow, Newcastle and Edinburgh. I'm everywhere in the next few months. So if you want to come down, the tickets are available. If you go to atifnawaz.com/live, that will get you there. Or just go to Twitter, man. Find me on Twitter. It's there. It's all there. Don't worry, Twitter. Just do Twitter. I'm going to get better at plugging myself. That was bad. I can eloquently describe like Bret Hart versus Ric Flair from 92, but I can't tell you how to make me money. How bad is that?
There's links in the description, so people can find you in the description as well. That's fine.
Amazing.
One final question. I always like to end on something a little bit retrospective. So a young Atif Nawaz has taken a chokeslam in the playground. And as you lie on the ground, you appear from the future. The Atif we speak to today returns to see his younger self post-chokeslam. What one piece of advice would you like to give yourself then? Based on what you know now,
kid, don't stress so much. Your life's going to be amazing.
That's nice. That's nice. That's lovely. That is. And yeah. Alex Nudman is the way forward.
And think of a better pseudonym.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.